thinking? And what you were thinking, too?
Okay. All right. You on, Daryl? Okay, good afternoon, everyone. This is Commissioner Brian Kalker meeting for an informal today. The first one is for case number PU14-668, Otter Tail Power Company's fuel clause adjustment. And once we finish that informal, we'll close it, start a new tape for the second one, PU14-690, a transmission facility cost recovery tariff. It is about 1:30 November 20th. These are all Commissioner Fedorchak's portfolio. I guess what I'd like to do first, is I don't have any opening comments. Maybe go around the room and get everybody's name, and then I'll turn it over to Julie if you've got any opening comments, and then turn it over to whoever you want to run the show for all of you.
Sure. My name's Stuart Tomerdahl. I'm Manager, Regulatory Administration at Otter Tail.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Bryce Helgen, Rates Analyst, Otter Tail.
Okay.
Jason Weyers, Manager, Delivery Planning.
Al Kakritz, Manager of Project Management, Otter Tail Power.
Sure.
Bruce Gerhardson, Associate General Counsel for Otter Tail.
All right, thank you, Bruce. Before I forget, I always make sure I ask the question. Bruce, will you offer all this up as your testimony in the informal today?
Yes.
All right, we'd be happy to receive it. And Mike Diller is joining us from staff, so I'll turn it over to Commissioner Fedorchak.
Okay. I don't have any opening comments, but I just wanted to confirm. Is it all right to do these separate, or do you guys want to combine them? I'm fine if you've got all your stuff combined into one kind of
No, we've kind of looked at them as two separate okay. proceedings.
Perfect. So. Then we'll turn over the floor to you and
okay.
ask questions
Thank you.
As we go.
Yep. Thanks for allowing us to be here today. My goal this afternoon is to, better inform you of Otter Tail's request to seek fuel clause recovery of these reagent and emissions allowance costs. That we're going to begin to incur over the next couple of years, and hopefully to help illustrate why we think that the fuel clause mechanism is the appropriate area for recovery. And so as we look at the agenda this afternoon, we're going to kind of go through and I'll give you a brief overview of the request. We'll take kind of a high-level look at the EPA rules, not a deep dive, but just, which rules are driving our need for some compliance response, and then what Otter Tail's compliance response will be in those to meet those rules. We're going to talk a little bit about procurement strategies that we've already deployed, and then finally get to the cost estimates of what we see in the end these things being. So if we go on to the overview of the request, again, Otter Tail is requesting a revision to its energy adjustment rider, and we'll call it the fuel clause, or is often referred to as the fuel clause, to allow recovery of two new types of operating expenses that we're going to be incurring to comply with federal EPA emissions rules. The two new expenses that we're going to be recovering are reagents, those substances that are used to reduce emissions. And then in some situations, we'll be purchasing emissions allowances to meet compliance. The two rules, the MATS and Air Toxic Standards Rule, is the one that's really dictating our need for reagents. The Cross-State Air Pollution Rule is the one where we'll need some allowances to meet compliance. And we'll talk a little bit more about each of these sections as we move through the presentation.
Just real quick, a backdrop. Yep. When will this ever get into base rates, if ever?
We looked at the different options of where these costs would be best recovered. And I think as we go through and kind of point out some of the characteristics of them, we can kind of compare and contrast why we don't think base rates is the best place, but that the fuel clause is. And we kind of start touching on that
so
on this next slide.
I don't want to get off track too quick,
yep.
but so at this point, I guess for me, my bias would be at some point in time, it does roll into base rates. So just something to think about. Because usually we start out with these tariffs getting the cost defined, and it's kind of settled down a little bit, and you roll them into rates.
Okay. I'll go through this, and then we can talk about the options. We've got three plants where that are going to be impacted by the various EPA emissions rules: the Big Stone plant, our Coyote plant, in the Hoot Lake plant. And compliance is going to vary over time with each of these plants. It's not going to happen all at one time. And we'll touch on the timing as we move through the presentation. It'll help illustrate where some of these costs are going to be phased in over the next couple of years. I think one of the key in the next two points are going to, I think, help point out, the characteristics that we feel support, including them in the fuel clause. One is that the consumption of these reagents, the usage of them, as well as the amount of allowances that we're going to need to purchase, are going to vary directly with the dispatch of the plant, just like fuel costs. When the plant is running, we're going to be consuming reagents. We may need to be purchasing allowances. And so from year to year, these plants are going to vary in the amount of dispatch that they have. Maintenance, a long-term maintenance type activities or major overhauls in one year, you're going to see your dispatch of the plant down. You're not going to be incurring those costs during that time. In other periods, you're going to see those plants running much more frequently. Again, it's just like the fuel costs that we incur. I think the second aspect that we need to consider is some of the market influences that may dictate, the pricing of some of these items. We'll talk a little bit about some of the proactive procurement things we've already done on the reagent side a little later, but we do know that, some of these prices on these things can vary based on market, just market demand for them. The allowance market has not been established yet, and we don't know exactly what those costs are going to be when we go out and purchase allowances. And some feel that over the longer term, we may see some of those costs actually coming down as maybe more allowances are available. We'll touch on that a little bit later as well. But these are the components that we see mirroring what happens in the fuel side of things. And for that reason is really why we're looking at the fuel clause as the best long-term mechanism for cost recovery of these items.
Stuart, yep. Do the purchasing of the credits, does that fluctuate based on how much the plant is used to, or is it just that the market fluctuates?
No, it'll be based on the dispatch of the plant. There is a slide a little later that will kind of help illustrate the variability of the dispatch, and I think we can speak to that at that point.
When you say dispatch, you're talking about the amount of power that the plant is producing?
Yep, when it's
sold. Because you don't necessarily always sell all your power.
Well, if it's running, it's being sold. It's based on the operation of the plant. So if the plant's running at, 200 megawatts, there's going to be a certain level of reagents and being consumed at that level. If it's generating 400 megawatts, it's going to be consuming, an incrementally amount higher of reagents. So it's, and just like you're burning more fuel at 400 megawatts than you are at 200 megawatts. So there's a direct correlation there. We'll move on to just a quick overview on, the MATS rule. And again, this is just to kind of highlight some of the key components of it that's driving our need. The rule was established and released back in December of 2011, applies to all coal and oil-fired electric plants of 25 megawatts or greater. It requires that plants install emissions control equipment by April of 2015. Now, there have been some limited extensions of 1 year that have been provided. Big Stone is one of the plants that did get a 1-year extension. second to last bullet point lists the various pollutants that need to be addressed under MATS. And then the last point is that to meet MATS compliance, there is no other alternative. There won't be an allowance market to meet those requirements. So there has to be, emissions reduction, physical emissions reduction. If we go to slide 6.
So how can you buy them then if there's no emissions trading type program?
Well, the reduction, the compliance that we need to meet in MATS is going to be done through the use of reagents. So there is, in other words...
That's different than the allowances you're purchasing under the CASPER stuff?
Yep.
What are those for?
We'll get to that. On page 6, what I've listed here are basically the three reagents that we will be using, and then I've listed here what the emission that particular reagent will be processing or reducing. And so the three agents are powdered activated carbon, which is used in the mercury reduction. We've got pebble lime, which is used in the SO2 reduction process, and then the anhydrous ammonia, which is used to reduce the NOx emissions. As we go to page 7, so how is Otter Tail going to comply with the MATS and regional haze rules at its three plants, and which reagents will we be using? The table here, we'll start and take a look at the Big Stone plant. As you know, we've got the major investment of the AQCS project underway there, and that project will be completed and going into service in 2015, in the fall. All three of the reagents that I listed on the previous slide will be part of the new systems put in place there to reduce the emissions. And as I mentioned earlier, with the compliance deadline on that particular plant, we did get the one-year extension out to April of 2016. With regard to the Coyote Station, we have installed a powdered activated carbon injection system. That's been working on that this summer, and that will be going into service this fall. Our compliance obligation deadline on that plant is in April of 2015. We also installed a similar system at our Hoot Lake plant, and that also has an April of 2015 time frame. Now, there is a footnote down there that I want to point out that at our Coyote plant, we have been using, there is emissions reduction equipment out there that has been using the pebble lime for many years, and that those costs have actually or were actually baked into our base rates in our last general rate case, and we're not advocating or suggesting that those costs would be part of this request because they already were factored into base rates.
That was my question, cuz I seem to recall doing something with that. What's your best guess now how long Hoot Lake's going to be running as a coal plant?
Right now, we're looking at the 2020-2021 time frame. And that's another good point because of the limited life of that plant.
Why you would not want to put it in base rates.
Exactly, because we can start these costs exactly when we start incurring them. We can end them exactly when, we quit using them. So,
could the Big Stone ones go on base rates? So we're not shutting down Big Stone anytime soon, I hope.
No, we hope that we're not shutting it down. I guess that's the question, is what's the right mechanism?
Okay. Before you move on from that page, what does Hoot Lake do as far as sulfur dioxide and both them and Coyote Station as far as the nitrogen dioxide?
That'll come into play in the discussion in our CASPER, in meeting the compliance with the CASPER rule. We aren't installing any new equipment to physically reduce those emissions at that plant. And that's where, as we get into the discussion on the Casper, we'll be talking about the allowances, and that's where the allowances will address some of those those things. Page 8 is just, I just threw in a few pictures here. Picture of the Big Stone AQCS project. The middle picture is the powdered activated carbon silo that was recently installed out at our Coyote plant. And the blue silo on the, at the Hoot Lake plant, you can see that on the left-hand side of the picture. One thing to point out, you know, and I think you mentioned it earlier, Commissioner Culk, that, you know, we've talked about these things, and now we're meeting the compliance. And, you know, as we looked at the ADP for the AQCS project, these reagents were, you know, a contemplated item, and part of the analysis is, you know, those projects were evaluated. And as you guys followed the baseload diversification study on our Hoot Lake plant, too, these similar types of expenses were contemplated in the life of and the determination of what was going to happen with Hoot Lake.
Stuart, yep. How were there costs, capital costs, for all three of these that you've listed? The silo, the two silos, and the AQCS, obviously.
Right.
And how are those being recovered?
You know, AQCS, we have the rider. For Big Stone, we have the, you know, environmental cost recovery rider. And I believe, did we roll in Hoot Lake? I believe we rolled in the last rider.
Would include that in the environmental
cost recovery.
Cost recovery rider, but
yep.
The Coyote plant is not in.
Yep.
That's just.
That wasn't.
That we haven't. Yeah, that hasn't been included in any.
Okay. But will it?
That would likely just, my assumption roll right now is that would just be included in our next general rate case.
Yeah.
The capital costs.
Would you have been doing it if it wasn't for these rules?
I don't think so.
No, probably not.
Without making these investments and incurring these costs, both for allowances and for the reagents, we'd have to shut the plants down. Most of them.
And we can get into this more later, but I think that all these different riders are confusing for consumers. And if we've got the environmental cost recovery rider that is for the purpose of outlining to folks, these are costs that you're incurring because of this action, right?
Yep.
Why wouldn't we include all of these costs there?
I mean, that is another option that we've talked about and considered. You could, in the environmental rider, roll the costs in as an operating expense, and then each year as we go through the updates of the rider, you know, you would put forecasts or estimates in each year, and then you would true them up through the process of the next update. So there would be a little bit of a lag in, you know, and ultimately they would get trued up, but it's just a matter of what's the right mechanism. You know, those riders, the environmental rider, whenever our next rate case will happen, you know, we'll be moving all of those things into base rates at that point in time, those investments. So then you have to make the decision, okay, these operating expenses, do they belong in base rates, or is the fuel clause mechanism for these variable ones, you know, the appropriate. You'd have to make that determination at that time.
I think I set up my bias early. I think the fuel clause was envisioned for some things, but not all this stuff.
Right.
So where I'm at now, it makes like a good idea, but we need to get you guys in here in a rate case pretty soon because there's all these riders everywhere. So either at some point in time soon you guys come in with the rate case, or we're going to be, my opinion, I would not be supporting some of these riders in the future and saying, look, let's get a rate case and get everything out there. Because it's time, I think, we get some of these riders cleaned up. My opinion.
Well, and I would just like to keep that out there as a possibility of consolidating the costs that are associated with EPA compliance in one place so people can see what it's costing. Mm-hmm. It's too diluted, and the public has lost sight of what's driving the costs.
Mm-hmm. That's a great point. It could be an EPA rider or something. If you want to stay out of a rate case, figure out a better way to capture that cost. Because when we did all the stuff before on this, there's nobody that wanted to do this. You had to do it to keep that coal generation alive.
Yep.
I shouldn't say there's nobody. None of our ratepayers wanted it.
Yep.
So anyway, not to derail it.
No.
Throw that out there.
Discussion. And again, there's three different mechanisms potentially to look at here. Mm-hmm. We'll touch a little bit on the EPA rules. In particular, on the CSAPR rule, and this particular rule has kind of had a life of its own over the last 3 years. If you may recall that back in late 2011, the rule was supposed to go into effect in January of 2012. There was some litigation that was entered into, and so basically the rule was stayed by the district court or Circuit Court of Appeals in late 2011. It ultimately was vacated in 2012 in August, and then this past spring the U.S. Supreme Court reversed that 2012 decision. In June, the EPA filed a motion to lift the stay of CSAPR, and then just recently after we submitted made this particular application, the D.C. Court of Appeals did lift the stay, and it will allow implementation to begin as early as January of 2015.
Is that under appeal now, the D.C. decision? Is that, or are we done here?
I think we're done. Okay. Yep.
This one is done. When the Supreme Court ruled, there is no further place to go.
So okay.
So if compliance isn't met through actual reduction of emissions, allowances may need to be required to meet that compliance. And the initial rule established two types of allowances or two types of emissions allowances for SO2. There's a group 1 and a group 2 allowance, and then there are two types of NOx allowances, either annual or ozone. Again, to point out that Coyote and Big Stone plants are not affected by this particular rule. It's only the Minnesota located ones, which we'll touch on in the next slide.
Is somebody somewhere reducing emissions? Or what is the point of all this if it's just trading around allowances?
A certain amount of allowances originally granted, but then in order to generate new, you have to have reduced somewhere in order to have access to trade.
And so how do we do that with, displacing fossil fuels with something else, or is there actually a substance that can reduce or a process that can reduce the emissions?
There's physical reductions being, deployed, equipment being installed in plants throughout the region. There are other plants that are being shut down. And through both of these, there's going to be the creation of additional allowances that can be traded or purchased by, those entities that need to buy them to maintain compliance. And so
you've just decided not to make any investments to physically.
Right, because this is specific to the Hoot Lake plant.
Yeah.
That has a short life. We'll touch on that in the next slide. This just kind of, illustrates how the allowance budgets are established for each state, and then they're allocated to the plants. We can move on to, I think, page 11, where, again, really CSAPR is going to affect Otter Tail at its Hoot Lake plant. Our Solway natural gas peaking plant does fall under the jurisdiction of CSAPR, but based on current estimates, we don't believe there's going to, in terms of its operation and the emissions allowances we do receive, we don't anticipate the need to purchase any for that. So it'll really be the Hoot Lake plant where we'll need to go out and make purchases to keep the plant operating at historic, you know, levels.
I'm thinking of something, too, more for Mike to follow up on that. You know, the commission had, how we had a lot of discussion, it was like 3-4 years ago. But then I can't remember if it was a case or what it was that we determined that what you're doing now is the best for the consumers given the scenario. So we need to put that in by the time this gets around to our order to put some more context that we've already given Otter Tail the signs that we want you to do this because it's the lowest cost given the scenario.
Yep.
So we need to put that clear somewhere in an order. I mean, that's the backdrop of this. We, Tony and I and you guys spent a lot of time talking about this 3 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Because the path forward is shut this stuff down or do this.
Yep. Yep.
So I don't know what cases that was, but we should put those in there. Here's the thought.
Yeah, and I think as we touched on earlier with Hoot Lake plant and its limited life, you know, going to be shut down in a few years now, our need to recover the allowances is, you know, it's going to be a few years here, and then those costs will go away when that plant is retired.
Refresh me on the capacity of Hoot Lake.
100, yeah, it's like 140, roughly.
140 megawatts.
Yep.
Okay. There's two units there. One's about 65 megawatts, one's about 90 megawatts. It's close to 140, 150.
Yep. Page 12, what this table does is helps, I think, kind of quantify the amount of allowances that we'll need out at Hoot Lake. The first box on the left, and what we're looking at here is the last 5 years of operation. And so that first column, total HLP, Hoot Lake plant SO2 emissions, that's the total actual tons of SO2 that were emitted in each of those years. The middle column is the allowance allocation that the EPA had determined for Hoot Lake when the initial rules were established. And so the red column reflects what our shortfall would be. And as you can see, the variability, you know, from year to year, we ranged anywhere from 932 tons of a shortfall to up to, you know, 2,355. There were various, you know, maintenance outages, different things that influenced the operation of the plant and the dispatch of the plant during that time frame. The box on the right is, you know, similar with regard to the NOx emissions. And so this reflects the actual emissions, what our allowance will be, and then the shortfall. We don't see a significant or as significant of a cost on the NOx side as we do on the SO2 side, and we'll get into those costs in just a little bit here.
What like the theoretical allowance of SO2, for example, of 1255, is that just a national thing, or does each state or each facility have their own allowance? Or?
Under CASPER, there were, and I think within, they start with groups of states, and then they allocated to each state, and then within each state, my understanding is they allocated to each plant certain amount of allowances.
So it would potentially be different, but about what are the allowances for Coyote and Big Stone? Similar number?
They're not in CASPER, or they're not applicable, or they're not going to be affected by.
We are issued. If it's, let's say it's 1255.
Yep.
But with your better equipment, if you're only using 1,000, does that mean you will have 255 of these
excess?
Sell? And so where do we take that into consideration that you not only have to buy some allotments, but you should have some to sell, I would think, too?
The CASPER rule as we mentioned earlier, only affects those plants in Minnesota. So to your question on any allowance or emissions of or from Coyote or Big Stone, they're not part of the rule. The allowances that are issued under CASPER are specific for CASPER.
Okay.
There's the acid rain program. There's another set of allowances that are issued to each utility. CASPER creates another layer of specific allowances.
I guess I didn't understand.
So that's the nuance of this. I had that question before, these are specific CASPER allowances.
Mm-hmm. What is CASPER? Just so I understand from a bigger picture, what is it? What is its point? What is it intending to do?
It's basically reducing the regional, haze. And reduce these SO2 and
was this part of that whole acid rain conversation? On the east, or
acid rain is a different program from my understanding. And I apologize, I'm not in the environmental area. I can't go too deep on each of these rules. But
from my viewpoint, they intend to CASPER to shut down coal with no benefit to the atmosphere. But the courts walked it through, and they lost. I mean, that came clear to me 3 years.
But it's only regional. So it's curious that it doesn't apply nationwide, and I just...
They targeted on certain coal plants, and the legislation is, in my opinion, what they did.
Yeah. Yep.
And they picked some old ones, and they developed a set of rules, and they pushed them through, and they won in the courts, and that's kind of where we're at now.
So the older eastern coal plants...
I don't know they're all eastern, but typically old. It's like they drew
Midwest,
a line.
Midwest plants and the general, flow from west to east... of the emissions of those plants.
And you had states driving some of the wanting to do that too, hence Minnesota, hence the Minnesota plant. But it's your plant. You've got to use it. But, I mean, that's my opinion, that's the short answer to this. It's a train wreck we talked about 3 years ago with all these things hitting about the same time, and now they're hitting.
Yep.
I was going to say east of the Mississippi, but Fruit Lake's not east of the Mississippi. Generally speaking,
yep.
But to your point, Julie, that's the part that let customers understand why this is happening, because from my viewpoint, there's no true benefit to North Dakota customers on this in any form. And we fought the fight on it. But
before we get into looking at the cost estimates of the allowances and the reagents, I wanted to kind of touch on some of the risk mitigation efforts that we've done in terms of at least trying to mitigate price volatility and supply availability on the reagents. And so what Otter Tail did actually earlier or late last year is embarked on a procurement strategy to get some contracts in place to for the reagents that we're going to be using. And so this table here kind of summarizes the results of that effort. In terms of acquiring our powdered activated carbon, we were able to, through a competitive bid process, get a contract with a supplier that will supply our powdered activated carbon to all three of our plants. You can see the contract term. From the pricing structure, the cost of the reagent has been fixed in the contract. There's a price for each year of the contract. There is a little bit of price exposure in terms of what delivery costs will be, and that's basically tied to the price of diesel fuel. And so, if those costs go up, they'll be part of the powdered activated carbon costs. Similar.
How do you get powdered activated carbon? Who produces that?
I mean, there's a number of suppliers that are doing it. I know. I think we looked at two or three. Bryce, three. You remember? I think there was three of them, three different suppliers that had bid to supply it. I wasn't involved in that specific process, so can't speak to exactly the location. But in terms of the pebble lime, we got a contract for the big stone plant because that's where that will be consumed. Similar pricing structure. The commodity is fixed at a monthly price or an annual price over the term, and then some variability in the delivery costs, the transportation of that to the plant tied to fuel. You know, anhydrous ammonia, we had a contract for that for Big Stone as well. That's tied to a published index. There wasn't really an opportunity or suppliers wouldn't bid anything other than that type of a contract. And so we do know that at least it's going to be tied to a market price, and it helps to ensure that we do have supply availability. So those are really the key things that we felt, you know, what we can do to manage our costs at this point is to go out and enter into those contracts.
How long are the contracts?
On the table there's the term. So, for example, the powdered activated carbon goes out till 2017.
Oh, okay.
The ammonia one actually goes to the end of 2018.
But they're not 20-year contracts.
No.
Okay.
We'll provide I'll provide some cost estimates on the slide after this one, but just to kind of give you the assumptions that were are assumed there. In the numbers that I'll share, that would assume that in every plant we're operating, in other words, it's after Big Stone is in service and we start to do compliance in 2016. So if we took a look at an annual cost then, and all the other plants we're assuming are using the reagents or we're consuming or purchasing the allowances. The pricing on the reagents are based off of you know, the historic generation levels and then contracted prices that we just talked about. On the emissions allowances, we used in the estimates the amounts that the EPA had originally included when they published their rules back in 2012 or 2011 for 2012 implementation, at $600 a ton for SOx and or SO2 and $500 a ton for the NOx allowances. We don't know, you know, until the market gets established and trading begins. That's really what's going to dictate, you know, the price that we'll have to pay for the allowances. Mm-hmm. I've read some, you know, reports and news that suggests that we may see those come down over time as more allowances become available, like we talked about earlier, where, you know, either plants are going to be shut down or emissions reduction equipment is being installed in other plants throughout the region where those allowances are traded. So
what is the actual marketplace? I mean, who sells them? Where do you get them?
Well, there'll be a formal market that will be established for entities to buy and sell the allowances that are issued to,
like,
all the companies.
New York? I mean, is this like a...
There'll be some exchange or some allowance trading administration, you know,
mechanism. It would be like buying gold or corn or something like that.
Yeah. I think it would be a similar...
And when's that going to start?
It could start as soon as January of 2015. If Casper does... with the stay that was lifted... you know, in October, it allows or sets up the fact that we could start seeing the compliance obligations begin in 2015.
But who's in charge of getting that market started so that someday at a certain time there's some markets available and someone knows who to call?
I'm guessing through the EPA, they're setting up or establishing the appropriate trading mechanisms such that these allowances
will be traded. That website works better than the healthcare exchange one did.
Well, then is there some middleman that's going to take a slice of it?
Absolutely.
For running it? Some middleman to run the market?
I'm sure there will be administrative costs that will be factored into whatever price that these things are traded.
It's not necessarily a private market, then. It's going to be kind of monitored.
And the thing to remember, too, is that the allowances that we need to purchase to keep Hoot Lake running can only be purchased from the entities that hold the allowances or that have the excess allowances within that same group two set of states. So that's just kind of the way the design of Casper is set up. So they have it kind of regionalized, and that trading has to take place within that region.
So this doesn't really get to your point of what you're trying to do here, but it's been a curiosity of mine with any of these commodities that, to me, don't really exist. So if you shut down a plant and so now you're able to sell those allowances because you're not producing anymore, can you continue to sell those for hundreds of years, or does there come an end point when it's presumed that that plant would have shut down anyway and so you don't really have allowances?
I would assume that if you shut down a plant, you're not going to be issued any more allowances. I don't know. There may be. Yeah.
It may be useful for us to get back to you on how the market operation works. We don't have the person with us today that has that information.
Yeah.
And it's only a curiosity.
We might just be
speculating. Yeah. Yeah.
These questions, and I don't want to mislead you on any of those things. So if you don't mind, I'd be happy to give you a little, send some information to you that would help explain how the market is going.
Yeah, we lost Mark Toma to a commitment in up at UND today. So,
well, at least he's at a good place.
Chuck brought him up there. So,
but I don't know when the future discussion is though. About we need to have this Hoot Lake discussion a little better with Otter Tail and the commission about what you're going to do and what your real plan is, because don't you have to come back to us before you shut it down? You can't just shut it down. Yeah. And so we need to get this refined a little bit better, because if you're going to shut it down in less than 10 years, you need to start getting something built.
There's work that is currently underway.
We need to have this Hoot Lake discussion, I think, soon.
So if we move on to slide 15, here's where we've based on the assumptions that I talked about earlier, we've quantified what we think will be the impact on an annual basis for the reagents and the emissions. If you look at the reagent expenses on a total system basis, we anticipate spending close to $3.4 million on reagents. And the North Dakota share of that would be approximately $1.4 million. The purchased emissions allowances, again, based on those assumptions that I talked about and the costs published by the EPA, we're looking at roughly $1.1 million on a system basis. North Dakota share would be approximately $450,000. We took a look at this, assuming that rolling it into the fuel clause and applying it on a kilowatt hour basis, the aggregate of these two components, and again these are going to phase in over time, but based on these assumptions, a customer using about 1,000 kilowatt hours on a month would see just under a dollar, about 98 cent impact of incremental costs that would get rolled into their fuel clause. So that helps to kind of put some quantification on what the monthly impact would be you know, 2.5, 3 years out, one, or a couple years out when all of these systems and upgrades are in place. We're consuming the reagents.
When are you looking to start recover costs on this?
Well, we most likely would see, you know, in April of 2015 is when we would really probably start to see reagent costs.
When do you want us to, when would you like to see an order that says this to when you can?
Well, our suggested date would be just effective at the beginning of 2015. The allowances.
And we'll true them up every December? Is that what you're thinking? So we'd start in January on these estimated costs that you have. And then in December,
well,
we'd do another filing that would, then we'd have to screw those back up.
I guess it depends. You know, we're proposing to include in the fuel clause, which is calculated every month.
Right.
And it's trued up every month. The mechanism is always trued up. Yeah, there is no annual true up on the fuel clause mechanism. That's trued up.
Some
month
of the other riders
month.
Have that, the transmission.
It's just the nature of, yeah.
I think that's that sort of annual true up.
Because those riders look at future costs. Mm-hmm. The fuel clause is always dealing with actual historical costs.
Then why are you even asking permission? Why don't you just flow through the fuel clause? You don't have to ask permission if you just put
well,
it in there.
Well, I think we do because of statute types of things.
There needs to be some time where we review this. Because I think for me,
right.
I don't want to just say it's open-ended forever. I want some of this to go into base rates. That's. I mean, I'm getting to the decision point now, but I'm just... it's just something to work through, I guess. Oh, the attorney's at the table now.
Just clarifying that the request is to amend the fuel clause to make it clear that these are recoverable through the fuel clause.
Right. Yeah,
because you saw what happened to Xcel when they started floating stuff through the fuel clause.
Correct. We don't
get right to the point.
We don't have that many components going through the fuel clause. This is quite new for us to make a request of this nature. But for the reasons of variability, like Stuart explained, that mechanism has greater flexibility and shorter durations. And so I think that's why, but we can't do it without.
Would you be amenable to 6 months from after you started to give us an update to what you thought was going to happen? Is that truly happening? Otherwise, we'll lose visibility every month.
Absolutely. In fact, I think that would be really good. Is that
for all of us.
There are a number of things that we are monitoring, but as Stuart pointed out, there's some uncertainty as to what's going to happen in that allowance marketplace. I think it'd be really smart to get in front of you and explain what happened after we know what happened. And if that's something we'd be amenable to having that in the order.
It would be in our intention, too, in the monthly fuel clause filings that we do make, that these costs would be, at least in the filing, they would be clearly itemized and identified, it's transparent from that perspective in terms of what the costs are being included. So,
could you do the same thing on the running these through the environmental cost recovery rider just as an operational
That is another option.
Type of thing?
We don't
or
update,
not.
Not on a monthly basis, yeah.
You couldn't function like the fuel clause that's monthly.
Right.
The way that the environmental cost recovery rider works is we set a fixed rate that's in effect for 1 year. We do it based upon estimates over that year. Then what we do when we calculate the following year, any overs or unders are part of that calculation. So there is, you know, sort of truing up that's occurring, but the shorter duration variability wouldn't be in that. And especially with some of this uncertainty, it'd be hard to estimate that, at least in the first years, we think. So we're
would it be possible? You're probably going to cringe because this is just a wild idea, but could you not rewrite the environmental cost recovery rider tariff to allow for a operational component that would function just like a fuel clause rider that could be variable every month as a sub part of it. So you'd have the fixed piece that's for the year, and then you'd have the sub part that would change, and those two added together would be what that total is every month.
We technically could do that. My concern about doing that is that it would add a layers of complexity already, whereas and that kind of thing is... Well, actually, it is simple in that it's already occurring with fuel.
Yeah.
So the mechanism is currently working how we want it to work for these allowance and reagent costs for fuel every month, as Stuart portrayed. So all we're doing is saying that because of the nature of these costs, they fit into the mechanism we already have. We recognize what you're saying about that there is some benefit to getting visibility, and I think maybe we should talk about good ways to get that visibility of these costs, you know, that are imposed by an EPA regulation and how are they affecting customers. But the mechanisms to try and impose a fuel clause type mechanism into the environmental mechanism would be a harder way to do it, we think, than doing it in through the fuel clause.
Right.
I hope that was a long answer.
I get it.
Simplicity.
But sometimes being expedient, you lose your opportunity to make a very important point. This is an important point. So customers can see what this stuff is costing them.
One thing that's sort of important to point out is we have what we'd like to do, and what I think you're looking at is we'd like to have them see the actual thing on the bill. Unfortunately, we have some limitations in our customer information system right now. The way our bills are collected and the amount of granular information is somewhat limited for us. And we've talked about that when we've had our renewable costs and some other things with you. So it gets very difficult, actually, on a technical basis. We are going through a process now of evaluating and likely procuring a new customer information system that would allow for that level of granularity in billing. But I don't know that – I don't think we'll have that for a couple of years. It's extremely costly to upgrade that customer information system. But that doesn't mean we're not in agreement that that kind of visibility wouldn't be useful. And so we may want to think about how do we do that. I don't know that we can have it happen in granularity on the bill, but we can have it occur
somewhere.
Well,
then maybe what we need to think about is how important is this to have the mechanism be just exactly like the fuel clause where every month you're doing it versus you're projecting for the year and recovering and then truing up, you know, how... It could be in one of the other riders that already exists and already are on your bills.
Actually, and I think that's a more important point because whatever the complexity of the difference between truing it up later is having it right every month, to me that seems – fixing that seems less critical than it would be to – if we put these environmental costs into the fuel cost rider, we're not just – not being real transparent with the people. We're kind of misleading them. When we say it's fuel cost and it's really environmental, it seems like we're really actively covering up the environmental costs that are being imposed upon you and passed on to them.
Sure, but one thing to maybe point out, and this is – right now, because of those billing limitations, actually we have what's called a resource adjustment for bill presentment, which actually includes both mechanisms, the fuel clause and the environmental rider that we were talking about. And so they're already in a single line item as an aggregated amount.
And what's it called?
We call it the resource adjustment line on the bill. But
what do customers see?
That's what they see.
Resource adjustment?
Yep.
And actually...
What in the world does that mean? Nothing.
It is...
If I could do this, Bruce. Yeah. I think if you guys got all your points out for this, because I think this is our informal discussion, and what we come out with, you guys need to figure it out. Yeah. because this is getting to where I think I've heard from my colleagues what they want, and we're going to figure out what we want, and then we'll let you guys figure it out. But we're past that point now, I think. If you have any other information.
There is information, actually. I think it's really important, and that is because when we were talking to you about that for those other components of recovery because there was an expressed interest in this. Our website has, and we do present sort of a broken out what goes into that.
We can do bill stuffers, and we can do all kinds.
Yep, and so we've been doing as much as we can to educate customers on what goes into that component on the bill. We can do more, if that's useful to you. We certainly are not against that.
I just appreciate you guys coming in and having the discussion, though, because the fuel clause has been, to Randy's point, it's the fuel adjustment is a different viewpoint than what we're maybe doing now. But we have to figure this out. So,
Commissioner, since you want to move on, could I just delay it just 30 seconds or so?
Sure. We just have one more informal to do, and I've got
okay, you've got to get going. Okay.
Well, but I would like to hear what Mike had to say because he came into my office yesterday and started this seed in my brain. So he's been thinking about this.
Well, I know that Big Stone One upgrade costs in the end are going to cost us close to $10 a month on a residential basis. And I think it'd be very nice to have. Right now they have a line item called REQ, environmental cost, on the bill. Or at least they're supposed to. It's in their tariff for those environmental costs. They're supposed to delineate it as REQ, environmental costs. So change the REQ to EPA, and you've got your line item. And if you're combining things, then the tariff needs to be changed. But in any event, it is important, and it's going to get more important. Right now, it maybe is only $3.50 for Big Stone One costs a month to the average residential customer. But it's going to be $10 here in another year or two. And so let's have the EPA environmental cost line on the bill so I don't answer that many customer complaint calls. Stacy does, but even the few I answer, I'm getting calls about this and what is this and why do I have to pay that? Well, let's just put it on there and then they know why they're paying it. Let's just make it clear.
We'll make the commitment that if you don't mind, I need to go back and talk to the folks who work with the technology here.
We have a lot of
discussion
to have amongst ourselves.
Sounds
good.
Yep.
For me personally, I think these are costs we got to figure out.
Yep.
We don't want to put them under the rug.
We're very much on board with that, and we'll, if you don't mind, I'll talk with staff to make sure that we can figure out our limitations. And
sure, sounds good.
Right, I don't think we want to write an order that you can't do.
Right.
Yeah. Thing.
But,
okay. So we'll schedule a work session on this.
But there's
Go ahead. It's your.
You're going to leave for the second work session.
I was going to start the second.
Okay. Good.
If that's okay with you.
Perfect. You're the chair.
Well, we'll keep moving, right? Okay, anything else for the Otter Tail? This is good discussion, though, back to the point here. So, all right, let's go ahead and close this informal, actually, for case number PU 14668. And then, Darryl, if you could stop the tape.